Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Rolling Stone executive editor Nathan Brackett. Today we're going to debunk some of rock's greatest urban myths. But first, we're going to talk about what we're listening to around the office. And that was a little bit of Real Love Baby by Father John Misty, a.k.a. Josh Tillman. I'm here with John Dolan, Record Reviews editor. Hey, John.
Hey, Nathan.
You brought this song to my attention. I guess it's been bouncing around SoundCloud for a little while, but now it's on YouTube and more people are hearing it. And I love this Father John Misty song.
Yeah, I think you put it out back in the spring, but now it's kind of been officially released. And it's, I think, is the first song we've really heard since his great record of last year.
I Love You, Honey Bear.
I Love You, Honey Bear, which was very much in the kind of like Harry Nilsson, Randy Newman, dark comic irony, kind of like almost a sensitive singer-songwriter record where the guy was sometimes not so sensitive. But what I like about this is it's just pretty wide open and pretty airy and pretty genuinely sweet. There's no sort of sense of like a cutting barb. There's no, I mean, he got accused of sort of some misogyny on the last record. This one is very sweet and very bright and kind of a nice early 70s folk pop tune that you can't miss.
I mean, I feel the same way. There are a lot of brutally honest, pretty dark songs on I Love You, Honey Bear, which I really liked. But yeah, it definitely, the world was falling apart, but we're together, and, but it's an imperfect relationship. And this one is, maybe he's in a different place in his life, but it's just a very sweet song.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So good for Josh Tillman.
Yeah,
we'll see if this helps his next record. Maybe not. But this is a very, I'm loving the song, and it's called again.
Real Love Baby.
Real Love Baby. John, you also turned me on to this rapper named No Name. From Chicago. Can you tell me a little bit about her?
Yes, 24-year-old rapper, poet named Fatima Warner out of Chicago from the same kind of scene as kind of come really coalesced around Chance the Rapper. She's been on both of Chance the Rapper's albums. And
Chance the Rapper has he's got a huge scene out there. There's so many people, art people he's working with. It sounds like just like the most fun place in the world.
He's been great about being a conduit for new artists, and it really reflects this kind of new realist but optimistic Chicago sound that's come out in R&B and hip-hop, and it's very obviously of the moment and very timely. And this record, she just put out a mixtape called Telephone, which is just really recalls the sort of like, it's got a 90s vibe. It recalls the early Erykah Badu, maybe recalls Digable Planets, that kind of warm late summer out on the stoop, conversational. The music is kind of light, psychedelic R&B a little bit.
And, it really kind of sticks out too. I mean, like, especially in this age of like, you know, we're in this age of like trap music and Atlanta music is like ascendant, and there's all these like skittering like hi-hat cymbals and like really complicated, you know, it's really producer driven age. This is super simple, just like, you know, really simple beat. Very sweet, as you say.
I think it reminds you of doo-wop. It reminds you of girl group music, but it's completely modern sounding, and the tracks are complicated but easy, kind of flowing. And it's nice to hear kind of just easygoing late summer music.
I used to have a name and look like butterflies and Hennessy. I'll trade it in for happiness, but joyful don't remember me. Sitting on my front lawn, waiting for him to call me. He said he.
So a couple of the songs, why don't we mention the ones that you've been digging?
Sunny Duet is one I really like, which is the one where I think really reminds me the most of like early like sort of Digable Planets. And then this Diddy Bop is very similar. The record is really of a piece. It's not like there are these big songs that jump out. It's a 30-minute, it flows beautifully. I mean, the production and some of the guests, it all kind of comes together.
Run, run, mama's take him home before the street lights do. Ice cream on my front porch and my new football and my A1s too. Watching my happy block, my whole neighborhood hit the Diddy Bop.
There's another record I just want to quick mention that's from the same scene that I don't know if we had a chance to talk about, which came out in early July, this Jamila Woods record, which is also, she's also on the Chance on Coloring Book, and It's
and
similar.
Definitely of a piece too.
Same scene, like, you know, same, and like the song on that record I'd want to point people to is this song called LSD, which is really embodies what this music kind of is. It's obviously you think LSD, but actually it stands for Lakeshore Drive. And It's like, if you gotta love me, you gotta love the lake. You know?
Not to be confused with the band with a similar name, Lake Street Dive, kind of more jazzy and NPR friendly.
Well, this is, you know, this is not NPR friendly as well. So it is kind of like recalls 70s R&B. This song particularly has the synths are a little bit, the keyboards a little bit kind of remind you of like Stevie Wonder's Secret Life of Plants or something.
Let's not sell short the NPR listeners. They might dig this too.
There's a little overlap here, so let's not be, they're good, they're great people. I know some of my best friends are NPR listeners. I mean, the way that the Jamila Woods song LSD is really becomes an anthem kind of for, like, you know, you have to embrace, if you want to embrace me, you have to embrace the city. If you want to embrace the city, you have to embrace me. She represents the city in a certain sense. The No Name record kind of gets inside the commonplace everyday life of living in the city. And they work well together, and you should play them right in a row because they're both great.
And they're also good kind of summer hip-hop records.
Summer's coming out. We only have so much more time for summer rap, so we should really
get it while you can. Get the summer hip-hop records while you can.
Get it while you're hot.
Yeah. That's right. All right, John Dolan, thanks for coming on.
You bet.
And that was, of course, In the Air Tonight by Phil Collins, one of the songs which has been associated with urban legends and conspiracy theories, which we're going to dispel in this episode. This is a special public service episode of Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm here with Andy Green.
Hey, Andy.
We're going to talk about some of rock and pop and hip hop's greatest urban legends, and also how they get formed, what's changed in the internet age. And we're also, of course, going to go through a bunch of them and help dispel them. Some of them have been dispelled before, but I feel like it's an important thing to do every once in a while. Andy, let's start with In the Air Tonight. So tell me about that one.
So
what do people think?
The urban legend goes that Phil Collins, back in the early 80s, was taking a walk or something by a lake, saw a man drowning, but couldn't reach him, but saw a second man near the man that could have saved him, but chose not to. And he allowed the guy to drown. And then Phil sent the guy that lived a ticket to his concert in the first row. Then he sang In the Air Tonight, and he sang it right to him. And
wow.
With those lines, if you told me you were drowning, I would not lend a hand. I've seen your face before, my friend. You know?
Right. And like, you could just see it in your head, like, you know, this huge concert confrontation Phil's like singing to someone in the front row. Like, I guess this conspiracy has the benefit of, like, the song itself reinforces it every time you hear it. The song actually describes the events that happened.
Well, it's a very ominous song. He's like, I remember, right. Don't worry, how could I ever forget? It was the first time, the last time we ever met.
Right, yeah. So it's like Phil Collins, it's like the song is like this gotcha.
Right,
he like,
yes.
Yeah. But in fact, of course, let's just say for the record, the song is about his ex-wife. It's about a broken relationship.
Right. He was going through a really, really bad divorce. He was in his basement with his drum machine, and this stream of conscious lyrics just came out that tells him the story. It's just raw anger and just random words that came out of his head about drowning and whatnot.
And he has been asked about this, I think, recently on This American Life. He said, I don't even know what some of the lyrics are about.
Right,
They're obviously coming from, like, a painful place.
And then it was kind of dying in the early 2000s, and then Stan came out by Eminem, where he repeats the whole thing in the song. Do you know the song by Phil Collins, In the Air of the Night, about the guy that was drowning, that you didn't save the guy?
Right.
I mean, then it was monster hit. It was back
Irresponsible.
Again.
Yes. Of Eminem.
Yeah, but Phil did not witness a man drowning. No, but he did it in the voice of Stan, who was a crazed person anyway, so I think that was sort of the point. Stan's
that's
crazy that he believes it's a legend, yes.
Well, let's back up for a minute. Let's start with one of the of all kind of rock urban legends, which is, of course, the Paul is Dead.
Right, that's the mother, that's this crazy huge one. I think this was back in a time when people would stare at covers of Beatles records forever, would play them over and over again.
Because that's one of the main ways you could get information about the Beatles. Well, tell me exactly
the story varies a bit. I think the legend is sometime in 1966 or 1967, Paul McCartney died in a car crash. Thus, the lyric of A Day in the Life, he blew his mind out in a car. He noticed that the light had changed. And now there's a dead Beatle, so they panic.
Don't people know that's a Lennon verse?
Right,
or maybe he was talking about
Paul.
Of course, that would only make sense. Yeah.
Right. And so the Beatles were this huge band, and they couldn't have a dead Paul, so they found somebody new that looked just like him. It was possibly named Billy Shears.
He was the same guy who actually went on tour with Beatlemania in the 70s, where people were acting and later starred in a Broadway
this was his early
jukebox
work.
Musical.
Sorry. But so it's a super secret. There's a new Paul, and Paul is dead, but they start to put clues in their lyrics, in their artwork. And thus, you know, it's like most conspiracies. If you believe something, then you see evidence of it everywhere.
Right.
So many lyrics on Sgt. Pepper and all over the White Album.
What
and
were a couple of the places that people...
Well, they really obsessed over the Abbey Road cover. Because they said, oh, look, this is Paul's barefoot. Because,
this is, of course, the famous cover with them walking across the street.
That he's the corpse, you're buried in bare feet, and George is the gravedigger in denim, and John's the priest or whatever, and Ringo's the mourner. Right. I forget exactly. And then the Sgt. Pepper cover, you know, they think, oh, look, this is it. This is his funeral. This is everybody at his funeral, and the flowers, like the flowers at the funeral.
Right.
And it was extremely widespread to the point that 1971, when John was furious at Paul and recorded Where Do You Sleep with George on guitar, he sang those freaks were right when they said you were dead.
Right.
You know.
The Beatles themselves, did they enjoy this on some level,
though? Yeah, I think eventually they basically started to just troll the fans. I mean, when the license plate on the cover of Abbey Road says 28 if, that'd be 28 if he had lived.
Right.
You know, I think that by that point, by the end of the Beatles, they decided to embrace it and just have some fun with it.
Right. And then just basically with time, it faded.
But again, this is so pre-internet that these are just rumors spread through playgrounds and whatnot. It's hard to refute them without the internet, which also spreads it. But yeah.
Let's talk about one of the most evocative rumors, too. Yeah. This is another big one that I think was just accepted as fact when I was a kid in the 70s and 80s about Rod Stewart.
Yeah, there's an urban legend that Rod Stewart, at some point in the 70s, got rushed to a hospital and his stomach was pumped.
With semen.
And they remove like a gallon of semen or something crazy.
Right.
And it's a pretty nasty rumor. He laughed about it. He goes like, what happened? Did I blow an entire fleet of sailors or something? You know. But this is so widespread that I heard this as a kid. Though the first version that I heard was it happened to a cheerleader at some rival school. So it just sort of morphed over the years.
Yeah, I mean, we could take one step back, actually, and say, like, this actually fits into kind of one of the categories of, like, kind of rock urban legends or just urban legends in general. Like, you definitely see that the stomach pump myth is definitely, like, taking its form. I think there was a hip-hop version of it for Lil' Kim, believe it or not.
Yeah, and for Elton John.
For Elton John. This has been a urban legend, which has mutated over the years. Another one is like a version of the Richard Gere, you know,
the gerbil,
being rushed to the gerbil in your pants myth. But the great thing about the Rod Stewart one is that he actually did finally put it to bed in his book a couple years ago, which is super entertaining.
Yeah.
And he gave the actual story.
Right. It was his publicist that he fired, and his publicist was so bitter.
He had a very flamboyant publicist who was bitter.
Yeah, and he just leaked it to some press outlet that just ran it.
Actually just made up a great story.
Yeah, he was thinking to himself, now what's the nastiest rumor I can make up about Rod Stewart?
Right.
And boom, and it just spread for years and years and years. But to Rod's credit, when it comes up in the press, which does a lot, he just laughs. He thinks it's so ridiculously funny.
Right.
You know.
There are a couple Manson-related rumors, both for Charles Manson and Marilyn Manson.
Yeah.
All right. Do you want to tell me the Charles Manson rumor?
Yeah, there's a widespread rumor in the 60s and 70s that Charles Manson, that he tried out to be one of the Four Monkees and was turned down. Now, that disregards the fact that the Monkees formed in 1965, and he was in prison until 1967.
I could see how that caught on, because pre-internet, at least, because it's weird but not totally improbable.
Well,
it's not totally crazy.
He was a struggling musician.
Right.
And he did want to be famous, and he was a California figure. I think one reason it's persisted for so long is because the thought was, God, if he only made the Monkees, then that wouldn't have happened. It's sort of like Hitler and his art school, that if only Hitler, if he was taken into the art school, there would be no Holocaust.
Right.
if only Charles Manson had been a monkey, there would be no mass murderers of all those innocent people.
And it's just funny, too. The idea of him in the monkeys is just funny.
Yes, because they were carefree.
Crazy eyes are right next to Mickey Dolenz.
Yeah, there would be a monkey that has a swastika on his forehead.
It would have made head even weirder.
Yeah.
Okay, then there's a good Marilyn Manson.
Oh, there's a lot of Marilyn Manson ones. I was in like 8th, 9th grade at the peak of the Manson mania, and almost every day I would hear a different one. You'd hear that he had a rib surgically removed so he could blow himself. You heard he would kill puppies on stage, or he wouldn't finish a concert till the audience killed a puppy. You heard that he was both the oldest son on Mr. Belvedere, which I heard a lot, but the most persistent one across the country was he was Paul from the Wonder Years. Because they did look alike a little bit. You could sort of see an adult Paul with Marilyn Manson.
This is kind of a subset of the Mike D was related to Dustin Diamond from Saved by the Bell.
Right. Because that makes sense, right. And they're diamond.
They look alike.
Right. They're same age, roughly.
Right.
So that made sense. But with Manson, I think, you know, he was so over the top and so wanted to spread misinformation about him. He's some kid from Ohio named Brian.
Right.
You know, that there's not much mystery there.
Yeah.
But if all of a sudden he's this satanic thing, or he's killing puppies, or he's secretly a child actor, then the story is a lot more interesting. So he had no interest in sort of squashing these. He'd almost spread them.
Yeah, I mean, those puppy rumors and the rib rumor, you can see, I mean, his entire career was devoted to, like, perpetrating rumors like that, I'm sure. But I can see what maybe the Wonder Years one wasn't part of his campaign.
It was just so funny because he was such a dork on the Wonder Years. You know, to imagine that the dorkiest kid in the world becomes like a Satan worshiper was just irresistible. And again, this was when the internet was just starting, where there's like AOL message boards.
Right.
And, you know, if you're in 8th grade and you're reading your AOL message boards, this is the kind of stuff you read all the time. It just seemed real because he was a scary figure, if you know much. His image was so carefully crafted that it seemed like he was actually like the devil or something.
Well, the site Snopes.com was in its infancy or hadn't been invented yet.
It's been very helpful.
Helped put down a lot of these rumors.
Yes.
Maybe we'll take a step back and talk about what the internet has done to kind of urban legends like this, because it's definitely helped put down some of the rumors that you can fact check, but it's kind of amplified some of the rumors that cannot be disproved.
It's given a forum to conspiracy mongers like Alex Jones.
The epitome of this would be the Jay-Z Illuminati rumor, which is kind of like probably the biggest, biggest urban legend kind of today, right?
Right. There's a huge percent of the country that believes in these conspiracy theories, and they can all get together on the internet, share their evidence, like, and point to photos. You say, hey, do you see this thing here? This is the triangle that shows that he is a member of that group.
Right.
You know, and so the internet can really spread these things further if you go on the crazy websites or there are email chains and forwards of all this stuff.
Can you talk about the Jay-Z Illuminati rumor? What is that? That's Jay-Z, Beyonce now, probably Blue Ivy, possibly Madonna, who did a song about it. Almost every major star at some point is a member of the Illuminati.
Yeah. There's a
which is a secret society.
Right. Yeah, there's a widespread theory that these famous people aren't famous because of their accomplishments. They were selected by this secret organization that they're a part of. And so almost everybody that's super famous, they say, oh, they're a secret member of it, you know, and they think Howard Stern's a part of it or Obama and Oprah, and they have secret meetings. It's sort of a way to imagine that the world is just controlled by some shadowy thing that they're all the puppets of.
Right. And it's the classic way to kind of explain somebody who you think maybe shouldn't be famous is famous.
Right. And I think it's often people in their life that don't have a lot going on. They can sit back and think, oh, well, my life sucks because I wasn't selected. You know, these rich people, they were touched down by the heavens, you know, then they're part of this crazy group.
One pretty big conspiracy theorist these days we were talking about earlier is Professor Griff from Public Enemy.
He's the OG conspiracy theorist. He destroyed Public Enemy almost by telling the Washington Times that Jews are responsible for a majority of the wickedness in the world.
Yeah,
he was citing Holocaust-age propaganda about the Jews, and it was, horrible, and he was fired from the group. But nowadays, he's on Alex Jones a lot.
He's redirected his conspiracy theory energies towards the people like Jay-Z.
If you hear his interviews, he believes in basically every conspiracy ever.
Right.
You know, which is pretty awesome because so many of these, they contradict each other. Like, you can't believe in all these things at once.
Right.
But, you know, in the age of the internet, I mean, like, the you know, and Obama is always at the center of these things, too. You know?
Right. Let's cover a couple other classic rock ones. Okay, you are saying that Jimi Hendrix did not actually put LSD in his headband.
No, Jimi Hendrix, he did many hardcore psychedelic drugs. You know, he was a huge drug user, but the story that he put LSD in his bandana on stage, and so as he sweat, it would dissolve into his skin and he would have greater acid trips during the show.
This was another one that was just accepted as fact.
Right.
When I was a
kid. This is real 80s era playground stuff about Hendrix. And he certainly did LSD, but not in that crazy sweatband way.
There are more efficient ways to do LSD than to put it in your headband.
Yes, that didn't happen.
It just doesn't make sense.
No.
All right, well, this is one that's partially based in some fact. Maybe the Keith Richards getting a blood transfusion, you're not going to tell me this isn't true.
But the story goes that in the early 70s, in Exile on Main Street, Keith Richards went to some secret Swiss clinic where all his blood got swapped out. It was like an oil change on a car where they took all of it out and replaced it with other blood slowly. So to cure him of his drug addiction.
Right.
And it's not even remotely true.
So did this have any basis in fact? Did he cover this in his book?
He's discussed it as like that didn't happen at all. It's just 100% false.
Do we know where it came from?
I think that's sort of hard to trace. It just sort of, it was so outlandish, but for him, it sort of made sense. I'm not sure of the origin of it.
Why don't we wrap up with kind of an update of a classic legend. Supposedly, Paul is dead is another kind of meme. This is one that's kind of like took on a new life maybe 10 or 15 years ago with Avril Lavigne, of all people.
There was a consensus among a lot of young fans on the internet that she'd hung herself around 2003, was replaced by a doppelganger, which explains her move away from songs like Skater Boy and to sort of different kind of fare.
Was this pre-girlfriend?
Pre-girlfriend.
Okay. All right.
This is like 2003-04 era.
Okay.
And they would put side-by-side pictures and see how her nose looks different, her teeth look different. This is an imposter. This explains why the music changed. And my favorite detail is they were pointing to the fact that her clothing had changed, that her style changed a lot.
She was not wearing kilts.
Yeah.
Anymore.
Right. Right. Or those knit caps or anything.
Right.
And this is just message board crap. But for some reason, it got lots of currency. There's a real belief that Avril's changed so much, that we miscomplicated Avril so much, that it's like that Avril has died. And the story goes that her parents got divorced and she went back to their house and it was empty of all their old furniture and she hung herself. But we can't have no Avril, so they found a new Avril. But young fans on the internet saw through it. And
And this is one ultimately that did she end up addressing this in any interviews or at the time did this actually have to be actively batted down or was this just this
I think
is another
it was
one that
just
kind of faded
it
away?
It just sort of faded away and then people realized that she's not dead, she's just older.
There's one other like urban legend of the hermaphrodite. Like a rock star is a hermaphrodite, has like, you know, male and female parts.
Yes.
And this is something that, like, members of, speaking of Eminem, like I remember members of D12 were rumored to be hermaphrodites.
Really?
Bizarre from D12. Of course, Jamie Lee Curtis was the
old
school one.
Of course.
And so there's something about certain things about either somebody being dead, either having to have their stomach pumped, either being a hermaphrodite. There's a certain like playground theme to a lot of these.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that if you hear it in the eighth grade, you're like, holy shit, you know,
right.
It just really shocks you when you don't really know a lot about the world, but you're sort of starting to get informed.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Andy, thanks a lot for your research into this topic. I know you've been working on this episode for at least 6 months.
Years and years and years. And now there will be no more rumors ever. We've debunked everything. It's the end of the urban legend now because of us.
A new age of truth.
Yes, exactly.
In rock.
Yeah, always.
Onward and upward. And that's it for today's episode of Rolling Stone Music Now. If you like what you heard, please leave a review on the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.